If you need a new roof or a repair, Easton Roofing will take care of you. Estimates are always free and suggestions are built on integrity. Visit EastonRoofing.com for more information. Get back to business faster with Easton Roofing. Easton Roofing. Integrity matters.
Impress your friends, amaze your coworkers, make your family proud. Here's what you need to know.
I'ma tell you what you need to know. I'ma tell you what you need to hear. Cause the truth will be too much. Yeah, the truth will be, yeah, the truth will be. I'ma tell you what you need to know.
Fourth quarter of the program here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Todd Lebo in for a vacationing Seren Petro. You need to know the Royals lost today 4-1. Had a bit of a rain delay. Bobby Witt Jr. hit a home run. Brady Singer gave up too many hits and too many runs, and they didn't score enough. There you go. They lost,
that's
Curtis.
That's a bad.
I mean, it could have been worse.
Recipe.
He gave up like double digit hits.
Yeah.
But only 4 runs in 6 innings, and he did, you know, pitch through the rain delay. Rain delay happened second inning, I guess. You know, it's not great. It's just this was a standard professional baseball game that you win sometimes and you lose sometimes, and the Royals lose more than they maybe should. Anyway, so the Royals lost today, and we are brought to you here in Need to Know by Jungle Law. Experiencing a rumble in the jungle? Call the lawman at Jungle Law. If you have a criminal charge pending, call him right away. The firm also does employment-related issues against corporations. Call Jungle Law for a free consultation.
Do you think he also helps if you're experiencing a bungle in the jungle?
You could.
I mean,
anything in the jungle, Jungle Law's got you. It's got you. So Royals are on their way home to face, I guess, Eric Hosmer. Hosmer, is he with the team yet with Boston? They play today? They played today. I'm sure he wasn't there yet. He wouldn't have played in that game. They lost, or did they win? No Hosmer in there. So Hosmer coming home. He was going to be here at the end of the month with the Padres, but that didn't happen. Now he's going to come in here with the last place Red Sox? Yes, last place. They are in last place.
That's how good the East is. They're a 500 team and they're in last place.
Over 500, yeah. And they're in last place.
Oh,
yeah.
That's just nuts.
Yeah, it's crazy. Hey, the Royals are in last place, and they're not a 500
team. They are not.
They're not a 500
team. Not all divisions are created equal or
they are
equal
not
at any particular time.
All created equal, no doubt about that. All right, Chiefs news today. All quiet on the Western Front. Good, right? Nobody's getting hurt. Nothing happening.
So.
They got rained out outdoors, so too bad for the fans who wanted to go watch them. So they practiced inside, and they went too long for Stephen St. John's ailing back. He had to stand the entire time. We like the tent outside as the media. You get to sit in the folding chairs, and you get to get ice-cold drinks. But we did not get that this time around for Stephen. He was as back was hurting him as it went along. But we did get to hear from Andy Reid, finally talking about Orlando Brown Jr. being in camp. They got that big fish into the boat finally.
It's a big fish. He looks good. You know, I know he's been working hard down in Miami, and I'd mentioned that earlier. So kind of keeping tabs of that as he was going. And it looks like it. Looks like he's in good shape. We're ramping him up, so we're trying to be smart with that the best we can and give him the work that he needs. But he's handled it very well. Good to have him back.
Chiefs will practice again tomorrow. They're off on Friday. If you're making your plans to head up to St. Joseph, they'll be back on the field on Saturday. So they will be out there tomorrow, weather permitting outdoors. Always, of course, check with Gary Lezak to see if it's going to rain. And I think tomorrow looks okay. I think. We had pretty good rain around here today.
Let's see.
I wouldn't have wanted to be outside having practice here. During Chiefs time, it was fine here, but it was raining up there.
But don't you dare check with Gary Lezak after December.
No.
Because he wants nothing to do with the weather.
Well, it'll be long-term. You can check in December what it's going to be like next August 3rd, because he might have that down.
Is that what he's getting into?
That's what he's doing. He's doing
long, so I can ask him my 100th birthday. I'll be
I don't
like,
know if
the
Long Ranger goes
like,
that
man?
Far. I don't know if he goes that far, but he's getting out there.
93, 94, 95 the next 3 days.
There you go. That's St. Joseph weather. Right there. So go after it and get up there and check them out.
Oh, wait, that's Overland Park.
Yeah, it's 64 14 and 12.
88, 91, 93.
Up north. Up north, it's cooler.
Cooler by the lake.
So nice. So
up closer to Seth Kaiser.
He loves it up there in the cold.
He does.
Yeah. He lives in the snow. It's probably already snowing with Seth right now, I think. It does that sometimes. Let's play one more. We talked a little bit about how the Royals lost today, but they don't have Whit Merrifield on the team anymore. He got traded. He's now a Toronto Blue Jay. We still haven't seen official reports anywhere of his vaccination status. J.J. Piccolo told us last night it's not their problem. He's gone. He's not on their team. It's up to Toronto. Earlier today, they're in Florida right now. Their manager, John Schneider, said, leave me alone, boss hog. Is that what John Schneider would say?
Something like that. He would have.
He said that nothing's changed in that status, so that'll be their story to follow.
And is his batting coach Cooter?
Cooter was there. So one of the things that the Royals have been trying to do, their stated goal, is to be more transactional, make moves that they should make and not fall in love with their players and keep them. They've liked Whit Merrifield for a long time. J.J. Piccolo said his vaccination status and the fact that he wasn't part of the team in Toronto last month was not a factor in this. But he does think that they're moving the direction they want to as far as being more transactional.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it was. We've added depth to our minor league system, and we've added depth to our pitching staff. So to get two players that we valued in return for Whit, I think is a win for us. I also think it's a win for the Blue Jays. You know, they added a player that's going to help them down a playoff stretch. And the same reason we valued him for a number of years is where his value lied with the other clubs. He's really good protection in a lot of areas. If you lose, you go on a 2 or 3 game skid in the middle of a playoff race, you may not be in the playoff race anymore. So I think it was a win for both clubs. I would classify it as transactional, but I think if you look at the entire picture, again, going back to, you know, the Santana trade, I think this month has been pretty transactional for us.
The month, not the day maybe, but the day too. I mean, listen, they traded Whit Merrifield away.
Yeah.
Right? It's a guy who they had under control for a little bit longer. Doesn't look like he's going to be a real big part of what they're about moving forward in 2027 when Frank says they might be good again.
Yeah.
Better be before that. But we'll see where they go. Like I said, they're heading back home at the Red Sox in town this weekend. Other thing you need to know, National Football League news. The league is appealing the decision handed down by the former judge for the 6-game suspension for Deshaun Watson. This smells like a fight is on the way. Maybe smells like lawyers making money, federal cases, and all that. They have not said what they want. Reports are they're talking indefinite and cut down to possibly a year. And that's probably not going to set well with the union.
Well, what I think is ultimately going to happen, maybe he'll be able to appeal it and dodge and get out of it this year. Although the way they structured his contract, if he's going to miss a year, he'd like it to be this one because they made this the cheap year for him so he didn't miss out on too much money. But what I think is going to happen is a lot of lawyers will make a bunch of money and then a judge will say, the CBA is the CBA and the CBA says the commissioner has this right, so you're done.
Could be. We'll have to wait and see. But I think the judges and the lawyers' argument for Watson would be at this point, this is just falling right in line with many of your punishments that are they have not had a case exactly like this. I will say that.
Right.
Okay. And when you look and they say in domestic issues, I don't think this fits exactly in that either. So people he didn't even know, who he would say, come give me a massage or I will come to your place. This is unprecedented. What he's dealing with, what the league is dealing with.
Nothing to look back on and go, well, how did we do this the last time?
And I hope, for God's sake, they don't have a case like this again.
I was going to say I can guarantee they won't, but
don't do that.
That probably would be a mistake.
But that's another thing to watch as we move forward here on where things are going with the National Football League. We had an enormous passing in the baseball world yesterday or last night, Curtis.
Yes. Vin Scully, you've probably heard the news several times and heard many of his best calls. 94 years old last night. I thought about, you know, if it's possible that someone that's universally beloved could die and have it not be a sad occasion. I'm not saying that it's not sad when someone passes, but the life that Vin Scully led and the career that he had, there isn't a lot of I wouldn't say tears today. It's mostly about the appreciation for, yeah. for what he was and what he gave us, and the facts and figures, the fact that his first baseball game with the Dodgers happened before Peanuts was in the papers, so he's been around longer than Charlie Brown, and there's all kinds of lists of those today. And, of course, it always conjures up. There have been a million websites that have put out Vin's best calls. And we did something earlier on the Frank Opinions as to what his biggest call was. And everyone voted overwhelmingly for the Gibson home run off Eckersley in the 1988 World Series. But one of the ones I put on there is Hank Aaron's 715th home run in Atlanta that night in 1974. And the fact that what you're going to hear here is in this clip is somewhat edited because we're not going to listen to crowd sound over the radio for 2 minutes. But this is not just the front end, but particularly the back end of what Vin Scully did in 1974 that night. Here's Vin calling Hank Aaron going one past the Babe.
One ball and no strikes. Aaron waiting. The outfield deep and straight away. Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone. What a marvelous moment for baseball. What a marvelous moment for Atlanta and the state of Georgia. What a marvelous moment for the country and the world. A black man is getting a standing ovation in the deep south for breaking a record of an all-time baseball idol.
That can't be understated, the way that moment felt. And Vin Scully, a guy who grew up in the Northeast, and he had no, other than having been done games down there, he wasn't a Southerner who kind of knew what the time was, but he understood what that moment meant. And it went beyond baseball. Mm-hmm. To say a black man getting a standing ovation in the Deep South, that was probably Vin at his best in that regard. And there was one more. I wish I'd pulled the clip, but the part of the 88 World Series call that I think no one ever really hears is a couple of moments after Vin says, and this is just off the cuff, he just says, you know, I said a couple of days ago that Kirk Gibson was not the most valuable player, that the most valuable player for the Dodgers was Tinkerbell. But I think tonight Tinkerbell backed away for Kirk Gibson. To come up with that line, mm-hmm. just off the top of his head in a moment like that is just one example of why, as I said earlier, there was only one in the box. There won't be another Vin Scully. Just be glad we had him for almost 70 years.
Yeah, a soundtrack of people's lives all across, you know, New York in the early mm-hmm. years, and then more, you know, for most all of the rest of us, that, you know, as the Dodgers announcer, and then other things too, announced lots of things on television. But, you know, when you grow up listening to baseball games on the radio, which is what he did for a long time out for the Dodgers, that's just what people heard and what they did. Then eventually he's done a lot of TV stuff for the Dodgers and then TV stuff nationally and World NBC Series. And, you know, that's where we saw a lot of the stuff growing up here in Kansas City. Was he was the guy who was on the World Series and, you know, doing those things. And back when, and, you know, we were talking earlier, but I think Joe Buck is a great broadcaster.
Yes.
Okay. And I know people got mad at him because he liked Madison Bumgarner for an hour. By the way, Madison Bumgarner was great that day and deserved every bit of praise he got.
As I've said, how else do you describe what he did in that World Series?
Yeah. Just sorry. Okay. Right. But Joe Buck is great. And Joe Buck, you know, is very good at doing the things too, sitting out and learning. And how many times did he listen to his dad call games or Vin Scully and all those things? So you see a lot of that in Joe Buck. And we like to hate announcers. We don't like this guy because we don't like this. I don't think you ever heard anyone, you know, I'm really sick of that Vin Scully. Now, maybe there were Giants fans out there who hate him. I don't know. I don't think so.
Probably not. He just seemed to have an affectation that was made him impossible to dislike. He wasn't a big homer. I mean, he bled Dodger blue, and he did all those Dodgers games. Anyone who could listen to his radio calls over the years would tell you, and plenty of people, I've seen them in print today, have said that for a guy who was the Dodger guy, he was not really a homer. He didn't overplay mm-hmm. home runs that the Dodgers hit, and he always rose to the moment when the other team did something. So I would imagine that because of that, he was beloved by anybody who listened to him. Yeah. And it came to a point to where how could you not? How could you not just stand back and just be in, not in awe, but absolute ultimate appreciation for the kind of announcer he was and the kind of person he was.
Classic broadcaster, touched a lot of lives for sure. And he's going to be missed. But you know what? You got all the calls. That's what YouTube and all the stuff. You can go back and listen to these things, and it's really, really cool. We'll take a break here. We're going to come back and talk some college football on the program.
Joe's Kansas City Barbecue burnt end of the hour answer. Tom Brady, 45 today. Who caught his first NFL touchdown pass?
Mike Vrabel.
Terry Glenn.
Oh, Terry Glenn.
In 2001.
She did a nice job.
Terry
Is that the old joke?
Glenn.
Yeah.
He goes back a ways. Talking about Vin going back a ways. Tom Brady.
All right. Shahan Jayaraja is our guest here from CBS Sports. But in the meantime, caller, we give away one pair of tickets, Adam? One pair of tickets. Caller number 8, whatever caller you want. We'll get a pair of tickets to our 100-year celebration next Thursday. So right now, caller number 8, we'll get a pair of tickets to our 100-year celebration at the Midland Theater next Thursday, which will be a lot of fun. But now it's time to talk a little college football with Shahan Jayaraja. Shahan, we haven't talked before. I'm Todd Lebo. I'm in for Sarin Petro today. Thank you very much for your time. How are you doing this fine day?
I'm doing great. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. I know you're a Big 12 man, right? You went to Baylor University, is that correct?
Yes, but please don't hold it against me.
I won't hold it against you. I went to Oklahoma. I don't want you to hold that against me, okay? So we're going to be all good here for sure. What do you think? Let's dispense the realignment talk and all those things. Where do we stand right now? What do you think's going on with this kind of game of it's not a game of chicken. I don't know what you'd call what's going on between the Big 12 and the Pac-12 right now with this kind of like little war of words going around. Where are we right now with this?
Yeah, maybe slap fighting or something like that. You know, it's funny. I think that a month ago, and really in the days after the Pac-12 lost USC and UCLA, it really felt inevitable that everybody else was going to scatter. But I think now after talking to some people around and also just kind of seeing how the dynamics have moved a little bit, I think we're probably a little closer to things standing pat, at least for this moment. Now, obviously, we saw last year that can change on a moment's notice. It really only takes one person to change everything, and that person probably would be Kevin Warren, the Big Ten commissioner. But, you know, at this moment, it looks like Notre Dame's not going to do anything imminently. It looks like the Big Ten isn't going to make a move on any Pac-12 schools imminently. And if that's the case, I think that the Pac-12 is going to stick around just a little bit longer in its current form. So, you know, I think for the Big 12, they're probably in a position to be a buyer if things break the wrong way for the Pac-12. But I think right now we're probably headed into a little bit of a stalemate for at least the duration of football season.
So you say buyer, and the question is always, is there something worth buying? You know, they went through this several years ago with the Big 12. They had a little committee to see if they should expand, and they decided that it wasn't worth it. They didn't see anyone who was worth having to offset cutting the pie up a little bit more. And I think maybe they missed an opportunity. In my opinion, the first time they added teams, I think they probably should have chosen Louisville over West Virginia, but they can't go back and change that. I don't know. It fit the footprint a little bit more. You can't change those things. They can't change the fact that they weren't proactive at the beginning of this thing. But what right now would be something worth buying for them? Is it which Pac-12 outfit might be the one? I saw comments from Utah's athletic director that, they like what they're doing right now. They're maybe not out there looking. Who knows what, you know, a public comment could be. They all lie. We know that much. But is there something worth buying? What would be good for the Big 12?
So I think that when you're looking, obviously there's been so much talk about those four schools in the Four Corners region with Colorado, Utah, Arizona, and Arizona State. I think that those would be the four that they'd consider first and foremost because they do sort of fit within the Big 12 footprint. Obviously, you'd be moving west a little bit, but you kind of have that bridge to build out to BYU as well. So I think it would make some sense. And, you know, when you're evaluating those four brands, obviously you're evaluating four very different brands, right? I mean, Colorado has a history in the Big 12. but they don't invest in football the same way that other schools do. Obviously, in Utah, you see the most successful school from a football perspective, but you're kind of crossing over your markets with BYU. And the Arizona schools, you know, Arizona hasn't necessarily invested at a high level. Arizona State has had success, but not consistent success. So I think that you probably need to evaluate how additive these programs would be in a potential Big 12. And talking to folks around the Big 12, it seems like it could be a little bit of a mixed bag. It's not going to be, you know, it's not like the Big 10 adding USC. It's not like the SEC adding Texas and Oklahoma. So I don't think that there's any sort of huge rush to try to make something happen. Now, the one thing that I will say is that, you know, a lot of schools have been in contact with the Pac-12 to try to get folks to come over, but it hasn't necessarily just been the Big 12 office. It's also been presidents at some of those other Big 12 schools that have tried to, you know, kind of keep things going to make sure that the Big 12 sticks around long term. But I don't necessarily know that that the value for either side, and that includes on the Pac-12 team side, is necessarily great enough in the Big 12 that anything imminent would happen. I think that this really would be, if the Pac-12 finds itself in a place where things look a little tenuous, then I think the Big 12 would have an opportunity to add a lot of the teams that they might potentially want.
Shayan Jayaraja is our guest from CBS Sports. We're talking some college football. And we have, you know, a new commissioner in the Pac-12 and a brand new commissioner who I guess his first day was 2 days ago now in the Big 12. I saw you asking questions down at Big 12 Media Days. So you were in the room with Brett Yormark when he was speaking and you're getting introduced, you know, from the frying pan to the fire, right, with all this stuff going on. What were your initial thoughts of him and you know, what sort of difference can he make for this league right now?
Very, very different type of personality than Bob Boolsby, who obviously, you know, had a successful tenure in the league, but is very much an old school college athletics administrator, right? I mean, he was athletic director at Stanford, athletic director at Iowa. This is somebody who's coming in from the business world. I mean, for folks like us, you know, who are from Middle America, you feel the New York coming off of him right from the start. I think that he has a reputation for being a deal maker, and you saw that right from the beginning because you did see him, you know, kind of say, our job is to increase the value of the league. Our job is to increase the value of these brands. Our job is to prepare for television negotiations. And, you know, obviously the academic part was going to be a part of it, but I appreciated that he was very to the point when it came to his vision for the league. He wants this to be an entertaining product. He wants to maximize the value for television providers and things like that, and give the Big 12 the best chance to compete on the national stage. So I think he set out his expectations for what he hopes to accomplish in this job very early, and I think that having that nice, consistent message is going to be something that really serves him well as he starts to, you know, like you mentioned, in the last couple of days, finally start this job in earnest.
And George Kliakoff, the Pac-12 commissioner, he's got a similar kind of varied background. He had been in sports and gone the other way. And he seems to be like filling some notebooks up with some quotes the last little bit or so. Is he just feeling his oats right now? Where do you think this is going? And what do people in Pac-12 country feel about what he's done so far on the job?
Yeah, I mean, to start off with that first question, I think that there's no question that he's seen what everybody is saying about the Pac-12, about the Pac-12 being doomed, about teams defecting to other conferences. And, you know, talking to him and talking to other people at Pac-12 Media Days, there seems to be, there's definitely, you know, I mean, it was definitely sort of a shaky time, right? I mean, people certainly are keeping their options open. But I think at the same time, you know, there is a level of confidence that if the Pac-12 teams kind of stick together, that this could be something that they can ride out. And, you know, I don't think that necessarily those four schools that I mentioned are going to defect unless they feel like others are going to defect first. And so I think that there was a, you know, it was interesting hearing George Kliakoff speak because I haven't heard a commissioner of a major conference kind of get so defensive and deal with the issues kind of like that. I mean, that's something that you don't normally see, especially with these lifetime college athletics administrators. So it was definitely a defensive day. It was definitely, you know, George Kliakoff trying to wrest back the narrative in some ways from not just the Big 12, but others around college football who kind of think that the Pac-12 might be in some trouble. But I think that ultimately, you know, I think some of his points were legitimate. It seems like his athletic directors and presidents, based on some people I talked to, it seems like they are on the same page with George Kliakoff at this time. But certainly, You know, it's easy to say that now. It's going to be harder whenever it's time to make decisions.
Well, the proof's going to be in the pudding. If they've reopened their TV deal negotiations, and if they end up surviving a little bit, I think the Big 12 and the Pac-12 and perhaps the ACC, they'll kind of maintain their TV revenue distributions or go up a little bit. The problem, it looks to me, and you tell me what you think about this, is they're just going to fall further behind the Big Ten and the SEC because of the power of those two networks with the subscriber fees each one of them has and the deals they're going to get. Is that really kind of the issue at this point? You may maintain where you are. You're not going to go too far backwards, but you're going to still fall further behind.
Yeah, I mean, it's an existential issue for sure, and that's why you've seen already people at Washington and Oregon kind of acknowledge that if we have an opportunity to get into this new Big Ten, we're going to take it. And I think that ultimately is the most confounding factor when it comes to the issues that the Pac-12 is facing right this second. So the issue is that for anybody who's not Washington or Oregon, and I know my colleague Dennis Dodd reported the other day that there are some preliminary discussions about Stanford and Cal because obviously they're great academic schools as well. You know, if you're one of these programs that's not one of those and maybe not Miami or Florida State or Clemson in the ACC, there's really no way to make up that kind of revenue. I mean, there's just not. There's nothing that you can do. There's no alignment that you can make. There's no conference that you can join if you can't get into those two conferences that's going to make up that difference in any way. So I think that if you are anybody, including everybody in the Big 12 right now, including most of the Pac-12, most of the ACC, and really the whole Pac-12 right this second, this is becoming, I think, a little bit of an existential issue of what is this going to look like for you when these Super Leagues kind of come about. Is there still going to be access to the national stage? Is there still going to be the opportunity to get great players and keep great coaches and compete against some of these teams? Because the reality is, too, right? I mean, the Big 12 is a great football conference with very, very engaged football fans. But, you know, if it does sort of fall to a place where the sport tries to make these brands not nationally relevant, even though I think they should be, I mean, again, it's an existential question about interest in college football across the country.
Shayan Jayaraja is our guest from CBS Sports. We're talking some college football. Let's talk some actual football now. We got camps opening around here. We played some sound bites earlier today from Lance Leipold at KU and Eli Drinkwitz from Mizzou. Let me hit Mizzou real quick before we get into the Big 12. Right now, the big question at probably nearly every college football town across the country is, who's your quarterback, right? And that's important. Eli Drinkwitz is entering his third year. And it's been varied success. I mean, it was obviously tough for anyone to get their first year on the job with the COVID and the pandemic and all the restrictions that happened there. He's known as an offensive guy. I personally haven't seen some insane offensive numbers out of him yet. They have a very exciting young quarterback in Sam Horn, who was a highly recruited kid, but he didn't get to camp until this summer. They got an old man quarterback. They got some guys who were there. How important is the quarterback position for Eli Drinkwitz, and how important is this year for Eli Drinkwitz to maybe make even more of a move than finally just making a bowl last year?
Yeah, I think they need to show progress, right? He's done a great job of recruiting. He's done a great job of getting some of those wins. And, you know, I think that you hear the phrase sometimes, off-season champions, right? Like, they've done a great job of winning the offseason. They had the number 18 recruiting class in the country this past year. They had the number 3 overall player in the country and wide receiver Luther Burden come in. But, you know, how's it going to translate, right? I think that so many of the things that Eli Drinkwitz was known for at App State aren't necessarily things that have translated in a major way to Missouri. It's tougher, obviously, playing in the SEC, but you know, a lot of that zone running game that they do at App State hasn't necessarily come through. They had a great running back last year in Tyler Batty, but it's not, I don't think, something that's necessarily going to play itself forward that same kind of way. So I think that getting this quarterback battle right is huge. It felt like Connor Bazelak would have a chance to maybe be sort of a long-term player for them, but obviously he leaves over the offseason. And I don't necessarily see somebody who I feel awesome about on the roster. Like you mentioned, they got Sam Horn coming in, who's a big-time recruit for them. Jack Abraham was a really, really good player at Southern Miss as a transfer, but you know, didn't get to play at Mississippi State due to injury. So it's been a while since he's taken live snaps. I just don't know who I feel good about in this room. And you know, I just think that if you are Eli Drinkwitz, you need to continue to show success, especially in an SEC East that's starting to have some teams that are finding their rhythm, right? I mean, all of a sudden, Kentucky's a team that won 10 games last year. You know, Tennessee ended the year really well last year. South Carolina has Spencer Rattler coming in. It's getting kind of tough right now for Missouri, and I think the worst thing that could happen to them is just getting left behind in that division.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. And one of their big tests early, I was out in Vegas a few weeks ago. I was looking at the over-under on Missouri. It's like 5. I'm like, they'll get more than 5. I start looking around. You're like, they're going to Manhattan week 2.
Right.
And they've got these games coming up. So I just laid off. I didn't bet either side of it. That's going to be a big one in Manhattan. They got the same issues, though. Who's their quarterback? You know, Skylar Thompson was there for years, and they've got Adrian Martinez is the guy. Okay, he's going to be the quarterback. I guess that's what they're bringing in from Nebraska. But if he's the quarterback all year long, I don't think that's a great sign for K-State because they've got kids on campus. This Jake Rubley, who was a big recruit, TJ Rubley's kid, right, the former Tulsa quarterback and you know, NFL quarterback. They need someone, in my mind, better than Adrian Martinez, or that's not good enough at K-State. Am I crazy here?
So I definitely get what you're saying. The one thing that I'll say about Adrian Martinez and the thing that I think makes Kansas State such a good fit for him is I think everything's going to be really structured. Obviously, we've watched him the last couple of years at Nebraska, and it was a lot of, okay, one read, step back, oh, no, you know, I'm being pressured, and it's over, right? And so I think that at Kansas State, he's going to have an opportunity to have a really designed run game. You know, obviously he has great running tools, but a lot of his carries last year were just scrambles. And I don't think that can be the case if he's going to be a successful quarterback for Kansas State. But I think that behind a really good offensive line, with some good receivers who have some big-time potential, and playing next to Deuce Vaughn, I think he just needs to do what he's asked to do. You know, I don't think that he needs to freelance. I don't think that he needs to try to play above his skill set a little bit. Now, the question is going to, you know, we're going to figure out the answer to this question this year. How much of that was situation last year and the past couple of years, right, to Martinez, and how much of it is just his limitations? I don't know the strong answer to that question, but I feel like he's going to have an opportunity to maybe take a step forward and maybe turn into a slightly more consistent player when he's going through very structured reads, when he's doing very structured quarterback run, when he's not being asked to freelance on the fly like he was so much last year. But, you know, certainly they have some talented players on the roster. You mentioned, obviously, Rubley. And, you know, next year they're going to have some a great kid coming in, too, and Avery Johnson. So they've done a great job of developing quarterbacks over the years. We'll see whether Will Howard continues to grow as well. But I do think that Adrian Martinez is probably going to be their quarterback for the season, and I view that as potentially a good thing.
Yeah, we'll see. I think you're right. If Colin Klein's offense, if they play kind of the way Colin Klein played football and Adrian Martinez's body can hold up to that, I think that's better. Don't make him make the choices because Scott Frost's offense was a little bit different. I'm rooting for the best for the kid, but I just think that for the Cats to get to where they really want to go, it's probably not good enough to do it. That's me talking, not Shehan Jeyaraja. Put that on me, okay, Cat fans? Don't get mad at me about that. All right, let's talk some Jayhawks here for a sec. Their over-under is 2.5. People don't expect much. I think they got a shot there. Their schedule's not the easiest in the world because they're going to go to Houston. That's a Big 12 game in a few years, but they're going to go down to Houston, who's getting a lot of love, right? That's a quality program there. Looks like Jalen Daniels will be the quarterback. He's gotten playing time in two of the years. Very athletic kid who had some growing pains 2 years ago. Helped them get their win down in Texas last year. Fought hard through the end of the year. Lance Leipold says there's a lot of good energy out there right now with his team. Things can only go up. It's been rough out there for them. I think I haven't heard anyone who says they don't like this hire and they don't like what they've seen from them. Could this be a year of real progress for the Jayhawks?
No question. You know, everybody's going to point to that Texas game that they obviously won. But I really look at those last three games that they put together. After Texas, they played TCU really close. They played West Virginia really close. Had a chance to win both of those games once Jalen Daniels took over as the starter. And remember, I mean, I know that everybody there is very aware, but they didn't have a spring practice with Lance Leipold back in 2021. They came into the season and had to learn everything really on the fly. And so I think that having a full off season to continue to develop and train and learn the system, I think that's going to be huge for this program this upcoming year, along with what I think is a really good transfer class. Like, you know, the phrase that I've used, I feel like, a couple times to describe this is a Power 5 transfer class. And for Kansas the past couple of years, it's been just a struggle to get up to FBS level. And I think, you know, the last two coaches were obviously strong recruiters who really weren't necessarily focused as much on the football side. I think you're starting to see some of the benefits of hiring a real football coach in Lance Leipold, somebody who has a vision for what he wants his offense to look like, somebody who has a vision for what kind of players he wants to recruit instead of just taking kind of best available and throwing them on the field. I think that I have a lot of reasons for optimism with Kansas. Obviously, players like Jalen Daniels have come along in such a big way. I think this running back room has a chance to not just be a really good running back group, but like one of the best in the Big 12. With obviously Devin Neal coming back, Ty Thomas coming in, some of those other transfers. I love the running back room, and I think in this wide zone system, it's going to fit in a big way. And you know, Kenny Logan, I think, is going to finally get some help back there in the defensive backfield. So it's going to be a process. Like you said, they're going to lose to Houston, but I've really got that game against Duke circled, I believe, in week three, because that's a game against a Duke team that's another Power 5 team that's a little bit of a mess. It reminds me a little bit of the game back a couple years ago in year three of the David Beatty era against Rutgers, where you're playing another somewhat struggling team, and you need to show that you're potentially in a better place than that program after a couple years of development. But obviously, this would be in year two, real early in the development cycle. So I think if they win that game, I'm going to feel great about their season. I'd love to see them pick up a Big 12 game and be competitive in a few more, but I absolutely see a lot of reasons for optimism with this Kansas team.
We're talking to college football with Jahan Jayaraja from CBS Sports, and let's talk about the league a little bit now. It's weird. If you were down there at Big 12 Media Days, you go down there in the past, maybe there'd be 8, 9 quarterbacks, and nobody was bringing their quarterbacks with them because no one knows who they are. For the most part, Baylor's picked to win, and I think they know who their quarterback is, but it's not last year's quarterback. I looked through the list. I think of the top 10 passing yards quarterbacks in the Big 12 last year, there are like 8 of them who are gone at other schools or in the NFL. You know, Brock Purdy and Skylar Thompson, but you mentioned earlier Spencer Rattler, and, you know, Caleb Williams is gone. And Jerry Bohannon from Baylor is now gone, and Daigie from West Virginia. So it's a bunch of new faces here. I've always thought if you bring a quarterback back and a coach back, that's a good thing. But I don't think you can even think that way anymore because of all the changes that are coming in. Who is going to emerge this year as a quarterback, maybe one of these transfers? We talked about Adrian Martinez, Dylan Gabriel from Oklahoma. You've got JT Daniels, right, at West Virginia. Who's going to be the transfer quarterback or Quinn Ewers? Who's going to be the one who kind of jumps on the stage here in this league and can maybe upset all of our Oklahoma State fans here? The two that we've had work around here, they hate Spencer Sanders, and I don't know why they hate him. All he did was get them 1 foot away from winning the Big 12 title last year, but he's back for his year number 19. But who's the new face at quarterback who's going to maybe make a splash in this league?
Yeah, I know that it's kind of the easy answer, but I mean, I'm a big Quinn Ewers fan. I got to see him play back in the 2020 state championship game down in Texas. Actually, on the other sideline was Cade Klubnik, who's going to have a chance to play at Clemson this year as the number one quarterback recruit. And Quinn Ewers is a special kind of passer. Now, the thing that I have questions about with Texas, they aren't just like the passer. I'm going to have questions about their offensive line and about their defense especially, but I think he's going to come right in. I think he's going to potentially have a chance to lead the league in passing yards. I think, you know, he's going to be the type of guy who I think right away is pushing for 4,000 passing yards in that system. Now, does that mean that they're going to win, you know, 10 games? No, I don't think that necessarily means that's the case. But he's a special talent. He's got a great wide receiver room. He's got an offensive staff that I think is going to put him in some good positions. And I also think that, you know, with the way that this defense is, he might have to throw the ball a whole lot just to give his team a chance to win as well. So I really like Quinn Ewers. I think he has a chance to be special. Certainly Dylan Gabriel over at Oklahoma, I think, is also going to have a chance to be a contributor for them. He's going to be asked to do a lot of different things, I think, than what he did at UCF. So I think there could be a little bit of a rocky transition. You know, for Kansas State, I like that they get Oklahoma early because I think they might still be figuring things out a little bit. But I think that Gabriel, you know, he's arguably the most experienced quarterback outside of Sanders in the whole league, including all the transfers. I think that those two guys definitely stand apart. But I will throw some love to JT Daniels. I think that he's going to be in a good situation in Graham Harrell's offense at West Virginia. I'm just a little more worried about West Virginia's offensive line and wide receiver play. And so, you know, he's going to be asked to do a whole lot, I think, right from the start.
But you are still, at this point, has not been named the starting quarterback, right? Hudson Card and here battling down there?
Correct. So, you know, it's going to come down to the wire. I wouldn't be shocked if Hudson Card wanted out of camp and then Quinn Ewers wanted maybe after that Alabama game, because obviously I don't think that game's going to go too well for whoever's starting. But I would expect that by the end of the year, Quinn Ewers is clearly the guy.
Who's going to play quarterback at Baylor?
So Blake Shapen was actually named the starter.
It's done. So he's the one who finished the Big 12 title game, and they him down there, and it's him. He's good to go.
So he's going to be the guy. So it's a little bit of a different look. Last year, Gary Bohannon, who actually since has transferred to South Florida, he was more of a runner, right? I mean, he was the big physical guy, actually was recruited to Alabama as a linebacker before committing to Baylor as a quarterback. But in Blake Shapen, they feel like they have somebody he's a baseball player. He kind of has that baseball-style delivery, real good accuracy. So I think that what that tells me from a Baylor perspective is they really want to go a little bit more aggressively down the field, right? Last year was a very sort of, I don't want to call it a plodding offense, but it was a very run-based offense trying to get 5-6 yards. I think they're still going to have that dimension with the offensive line talent they bring back, but I think that they do want to try to get those receivers involved just a little bit more. So it's a gamble, I think, in some ways by Dave Aranda, but every gamble that Dave Aranda's made so far has basically worked out.
Yeah, it's worked out, and they were picked to finish atop the league, and we'll see if they can get it done with a guy who's played some quarterback but not a ton of it yet this year. We're talking to Shehan Jeyaraja from CBS Sports. Time for our Final Four, brought to you by the University of Kansas Health System. Four quick questions with quick enough answers. Who's a surprising team you have nationally? Who's going to maybe come out of the being ranked 15th to 20th or something, who may shoot up there and be a top five team at some point this year?
Yeah, I feel like the team that kind of stands out to me is North Carolina State. I think that they have a great quarterback coming back in Devin Leary. They're going to be probably top 15-ish heading into the year. But, you know, there's really a chance that things hit for them. Again, Devin Leary's coming back at quarterback. They've got a lot of production coming back, especially on the defensive side of the ball. I think they rank top 10 in the country in returning defensive production. You trust that they're going to develop some guys at wide receiver, because the guys that they lost weren't necessarily NFL-type guys. And they do a great job developing on the offensive line. So I've got that game, North Carolina State at Clemson, circled on the calendar early in the season. If they can win that game, I think that puts them right in the midst of the college football playoff race and in the leaderboard for winning the ACC.
Mark that one down. NC State, one to watch. Who's going to lead the Big 12 in passing this year? We talked all this quarterback stuff here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, like I mentioned, I think that Quinn Ewers is going to have a chance, but I'm not going to go in that direction. I think I'm probably going to go with Dylan Gabriel. I think that you look at that offensive system. I don't love their offensive line. I don't love their running backs as much as usual years. So I think they might end up having to pass the ball a little bit more than they would potentially like to, especially because I think that this defense is going to take a little bit of time. So it wouldn't surprise me if they leaned on Dylan Gabriel quite a bit. I will say, if I knew that there was a guy at Texas Tech, I'd consider them after they brought in Zach Kittley as offensive coordinator from Western Kentucky, but I think that they're probably going to play multiple quarterbacks across the season, so I don't think that there will be a single guy.
All right. Number three, how much time did you spend at George's in Waco when you were in school there?
Not as many people think. They built up some new stuff over the past couple of years, but there's nothing like going there on a game day and getting to see some of the alums come through. So I spent some time there, but they built up some stuff since then.
Now, when you went to school, the question is Floyd Casey Stadium or McLean Stadium? Because when you were in school, I looked at your age. They hadn't built the new stadium yet, so you were there when they built it. How did that work, and did you prefer?
I mean, God bless Floyd Casey Stadium, but it's no contest. McLean Stadium is one of the best venues in college football, in my opinion. It's built right on the river. The views are fantastic. Floyd Casey Stadium, I want people to understand, is a giant high school stadium that they play college football in. Like, it was like a giant concrete box, and then they built McLean, and it's like a mini NFL stadium. It's so much better. But I appreciate everybody who has all the memories and all that sort of stuff, but it was pretty easy for me to move on.
Yeah, easy enough. I went to a game the first year at McLean. Rained on us, so it wasn't very much fun. Went down on the college football trip there and watched Oklahoma State Baylor. It was a lot of fun. It was a night game, and it was raining. That part stunk. And we spent hours at George's because, you know what? It was raining. And we stayed in there for a long, long time and watched that. Shehan Jeyaraja, thank you so much for your time. We look forward to your reports all year long. Nice to talk to you, buddy.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right, there, Shehan Jayaraj from CBS Sports right here on the program.
We're almost done for the day, but there's just a few more things we'd like to share.
But there's still more.
Here's the kicker.
Here's the kicker of this whole thing.
On the program.
Wrapping the show up here on this Wednesday. Royals lost today 4-1. They're heading back home. We never talk politics here, but I'm going to talk politics on an election. Our good friend Hurricane, he texted me. He said, can we get a shout out for his son, who was elected prosecuting attorney in Harrison County, Missouri last night. 74% of the vote for young Alex.
Nice.
There you go.
There's Alex Hurricane.
There's our hot poly-charged talk today. There you go. Congratulations to Alex. Little Kane. Baby Kane.
Well, the sports world has spent much of today rightfully honoring the unbelievable legacy of the late, great Vin Scully. We've done our fair share of that on the program today. One of the things we have not gotten to is Vin's sign-off on his final game as a Dodger broadcaster after 67 years, October 2nd, 2016. So, Vin, take us home.
You know, friends, so many people have wished me congratulations on a 67-year career in baseball, and they've wished me a wonderful retirement with my family. And now, all I can do is tell you what I wish for you. May God give you for every storm a rainbow, for every tear a smile, for every care a promise, and a blessing in each trial. For every problem life seems, a faithful friend to share. For every sigh, a sweet song, and an answer for each prayer. You and I have been friends for a long time, but I know in my heart that I've always needed you more than you've ever needed me. And I'll miss our time together more than I can say. But you know what? There will be a new day and eventually a new year. And when the upcoming winter gives way to spring, oh, rest assured, once again, it will be time for Dodger baseball. So this is Vin Scully wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon wherever you may be.